And good morning. Welcome. This is Walt Bodine speaking, and we're all ready to plunge into some good sounding, I'll forget about it.
Well, I'm not going to forget about it. We'll sound as good as we can today, Walt, with you at our side. Good morning. I'm Monroe Dodd here on the Walt Bodine Show. And good morning to you, Walt.
Well, okay.
Today's show is about fire. We human beings have intense but mixed emotions about fire. We love fire in the right places, such as in our fireplace or in our campfire ring on a cold night, but we hate it if it spreads to the rest of our house or to the brush and trees around our campsite. When it consumes human beings, fire is the stuff of legend. Think about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire, the Coconut Grove Nightclub Fire, the Great Chicago Fire, or locally the Coates House Fire. And when fire ravages forests in the Mountain West, well, news is made and books are written and movies produced. But when fire burns grassland, well, then fire is just a long way away and a long time ago, and no great harm is done, right? No books are written and no movies are made. Yet these fires, prairie fires, are their own creatures, powerful, deadly, destructive, but also life-renewing and even beautiful. Our guest today is Julie Courtwright, an authority on prairie fire. She has written a book with that name, Prairie Fire, A Great Plains History, and she joins us by telephone from her office in Ames, Iowa. Welcome, Julie Courtwright, to the Walt Bodine Show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, your book was just released this fall by the University Press of Kansas, and I got to admit, reading it, I came to a whole new understanding of prairie fire. In fact, you begin the book with an arresting story about the Wheaton family near El Dorado, Kansas, driving along in their ox-drawn wagon one fateful day in October 1872. Tell us about their encounter with prairie fire, please.
Well, the Wheatons, I don't know a lot about them, but they had quite an experience that day in October 1872. Driving along in their oxen-pulled wagon, Mr. Wheaton and his wife and son and daughter. And according to the newspaper account, they were about 9-10 miles west of El Dorado, Kansas, when a prairie fire approached. And it came, as they tend to do, very suddenly upon the Wheatons. And it was only 1872, which was pretty early for Euro-American settlement in that part of Kansas. And so likely Mr. Wheaton didn't know what to do, as many new settlers didn't when encountering prairie fire. The family stopped the oxen and got out of the wagon, which was a very, very poor decision. The prairie fire came upon them. Mr. Wheaton must have realized at the very last second that things were bad. He put his daughter into the wagon, but before he could help his wife and son, the prairie fire was upon them and overtook them. Mr. Wheaton tried his best to save his wife and son and burned one of his hands so severely in the process that he later lost his hand, but he couldn't save them. His wife and son died. The only person that was uninjured was his daughter, who was in the wagon at the time. The Wheaton story, it strikes me because that's the part of Kansas I'm from. I'm from Augusta, which is right near El Dorado. But it's an example of just how quickly and how dangerous these fires could be.
Yes, and I can imagine in 1872, without any broadcast media, without even understanding what life was like out on there, with very little experience of it, as you said, for European Americans, this must have come as a great shock to look out on the horizon. I suppose that's where Mr. Wheaton first saw it, the Wheatons, and see this big wall of flame coming right at them.
Yes. And very surprising, very shocking, and a lot of people almost were paralyzed at the sight. It it was hard to know what to do, especially if you were so inexperienced. And as you said, there was no advance warning a lot of times. If the fire was moving quickly, if it was pushed by a very strong wind, then a lot of times you had just seconds to decide what to do. The Wheatons probably didn't have a lot of options.
You grew up in Kansas, you said. You work now, you're an assistant professor at Iowa State University in History of the West and Environmental History, as I understand.
Yes.
But you grew up in this part of Kansas, in that part of Kansas.
I did. I'm a native of Butler County, Kansas, born in El Dorado, actually, and grew up in Augusta.
Have you ever experienced a prairie fire yourself?
Only marginally. Growing up, I was familiar, of course, with the controlled burns that the ranchers do to this day in the Flint Hills, and so I saw the controlled burns. I smelled the smoke every March and April, and so that's my limited experience with fire on the prairies, and of course that's a controlled form, not a wild form, which is quite different. But I think probably, growing up and being aware of the fires and having at least some awareness of how fire shapes the ecosystem in the prairies, I think that probably led me to this topic.
Your book shows a lot of marvelous research, extensive research on this topic, and I think there aren't many people who have done it before. What got you so interested in going this far into this topic?
Well, I knew, I was a historian in training when I started this research, and I knew that I wanted to study the Great Plains because Kansas is my home. I have an emotional connection there, and I wanted to develop an intellectual connection to the plains and really, learn about what made the plains, and the environment plays, a huge role in defining the region. And so just looking around for a topic that hadn't been explored thoroughly, I woke up literally in the middle of the night one night thinking about prairie fire and thought that someone must have already looked at it. And there have been a few people, Jim Hoy at Emporia State University in Kansas, for example, has done some work on pasture burning, controlled burning in the Flint Hills. But no one, to my surprise, had really gone into the archives and looked at the letters and the diaries and the oral histories that people had left behind describing this phenomena. And there are a lot of accounts of prairie fire. As I got into the archives, I found this out because people, when they experience prairie fire, they wanted to tell their stories. It was something remarkable that happened to them. It was very frightening. It was also it was adventure. It was beautiful at times. And so when it happened to them, people wrote to their relatives in the East or they wrote in their diary about it. And so there are just a wealth of great resources about this topic and really good stories.
You write that prairie fire, and I'll quote you, is as fundamental to the Great Plains as the sun, soil, wind, grazers, and grass. Why is it part of the environment, and what does it do in the environment?
Well, I write that because without fire, the Great Plains would not have looked as they looked when European Americans, arrived and settled in the region. The American Indians burned the grass extensively for thousands of years, and that burning shaped the environment, especially in the eastern tall grass prairies, so in places like eastern Kansas, where there is enough rainfall to allow for trees and brush to grow. It was fire and the repeated application of fire at the hands of the American Indians, it was fire that kept the grassland, and kept those trees and brush, woody intruders, you know, from moving on to the grassland and really taking over the ecosystem. So without fire, you get changes in grass composition, you get trees intruding, and a prairie, especially in the tallgrass prairie isn't a prairie anymore, really, without repeated application of fire. And so that's why I think it is as fundamental as those other things that you mentioned. And when we don't have it, the environment changes quite rapidly.
You're listening to The Walt Bodine Show on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, here with Walt and our guest, Julie Courtwright, who's talking about her new book, Prairie Fire, A Great Plains History. Have you experienced a prairie fire? Did your ancestors? Later in the program, we'll ask you to join us with your questions or comments at 816-235-2888 or emailing us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. Julie, you mentioned that prairie fire would keep down trees, but if it burns grass, what happens to the grass?
The grass is not hurt by the fire. It's actually helped by the fire. And that's because the roots of the grass underneath the soil are not hurt by the fire. And actually, on the Great Plains, the grass that you see above soil is only the tip of the iceberg. Below ground, you have, in unplowed prairie, you have roots that extend as much as 12 feet underground. And it's a very, very dense, extensive root system. And so when fire burns across the prairie, it only burns the uppermost part of the grass above ground. Below ground, the roots are untouched, and it actually helps the grass. Fire helps the grass because it clears away the old dead growth above ground and makes room for the roots to produce brand new healthy growth after the fire has passed. And also, fire returns nutrients to the soil because it aids in rapid decomposition of the above ground grass. It aids in just a lot of other things. Production of fungus, for example, that makes grass healthy. So fire doesn't hurt the grass at all. It actually helps it.
And when you talk about grasslands, we're talking about an area that goes all the way from the Texas Panhandle up to Canada and from, I think, western Missouri, according to a map in your book, right on up to the foot of the Rocky Mountains. Am I not right?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And this was what the first European-American explorers and settlers in this area came upon, mile after mile of unbroken horizon, unbroken by trees except in, I guess, creek banks and things. All the way from what's now the Canadian border to almost what's now the Mexican border, a grassland without trees. But when they came here, a lot of these people wanted to duplicate what they had farther east or in Europe, and so they began planting woody plants like trees.
True. Yes. The treelessness bothered these new settlers, European American settlers that moved west and settled in places, first in western Missouri, eastern Kansas, eastern Nebraska. The treelessness bothered them tremendously. On one hand, they appreciated it because they didn't have to remove those trees in order to put in crops. So it was actually good for agriculture that the region was treeless. But on the other hand, they felt uncomfortable with it, mm-hmm. Uncomfortable with the long horizons, uncomfortable with some of the openness of the place. And they wanted to replicate, as you said, what they knew, and what they knew was the more tree-filled east. And so once they arrive in the region, they immediately begin to picture how they can change the environment and how they can make it more like what they're used to. And so they begin to plant trees. And, of course, they before long, they immediately say, well, fire is a threat to trees. And so we have to stop fire in order to create this place that we want to create. And there was also some kind of funny 19th century science behind their actions, too. They felt like the science of the day told them that if they plowed and if they planted trees, that this would actually change the climate and that more rain would fall. And this, of course, would be good for agriculture. So there's a kind of a lot of motivations behind them, but behind their actions. But, yes, they definitely wanted more trees, and fire was a threat to those trees.
And, of course, they built houses and they built towns, and all these things were threatened by fire.
Exactly. It's a whole new lifestyle that the European-American settlers bring into the region. American Indians, of course, were more mobile, more nomadic. And if you move from place to place and you take your homes with you, then prairie fire isn't quite the threat that it is if versus the European-Americans. They came into the region, they settled in towns, permanent towns, they built permanent houses, they took ownership of the land in a way that the Indians had not. And so when you build a fence around your land and you build a barn and a house, then a prairie fire becomes a much, much more significant threat to your property. And so land use changed tremendously in the middle of the 19th century when Euro-Americans came into the region, and that totally changed people's perception of fire. The Indians used fire as a tool, as a way to make the grassland healthy, as a way to encourage the bison to graze there.
Almost the same reason ranchers, in the Flint Hills today burn a prairie. It comes back stronger and more nutritious for whatever's grazing on it.
Exactly. The Indians burned to give the bison healthy grass to graze, and the ranchers in the Flint Hills today do exactly the same thing. The burning makes the grass healthy, which is good for their cattle. And cattle grazing on burned land gain weight faster and are healthier than cattle grazing on unburned land.
Julie Courtright, you write that Native Americans had other reasons for setting fires also, sometimes for signaling or for protection.
Right. They used fire for communication, and they used fire in the hunt to hunt the bison, and in war, and sometimes just for pleasure. For the hunt, there was a technique called the surround, in which they would set the fire, prairie on fire, in a circle around the bison, trapping the bison, and that meant that the hunters could then have access, better access to the bison without them running. And so they used fire to drive the bison off of cliffs and to contain them. And in war, they used fire as a defensive weapon, ways to confuse the enemy. It wasn't very good, actually, as an offensive weapon because it was too volatile. But as a defensive weapon, it was a very good tool in war.
Native Americans starting a lot of fires, and then, of course, carelessness and unconscious starting of fires later from European Americans. But I guess I've heard for a long time that lightning starts a lot of these fires. Is that not so?
Lightning starts some, but actually relatively few. I would estimate that at least 95% of prairie fires come from human hands in one way or the other. That's because not all lightning starts fires. And those that do, usually, when lightning starts a fire, it's accompanied by rain. And so the rain then curtails the fire, of course. And just from my research and the research of others who have looked into this, summer, of course, spring and summer are the thunderstorm season on the plains. And so when lightning starts fire, it's typically going to be in those seasons. And those seasons are when the grass is green and is less likely to burn. But most historical fires, and the accounts I found, the vast majority of fires were actually in the fall, when the plains dries out and does not get thunderstorms and lightning very often. And so you have, there's just account after account of human beings starting fire. And it, you know, it makes sense that, that the fall is prime time for prairie fires, accidental fires in particular, because the grass grows tall in the summer, you get rain in the summer, and that makes the grass grow, which creates fuel. And then in about in October, the faucet's turned off, the plains dries out, and you have all this great fuel just ready to burn. And so that's when you get your large, big, accidental fires, because the fire has all this fuel.
Julie Courtwright, in your book, you describe I suppose it must be one of the earliest recorded fires by European Americans in the 1760s. That wound up creating, rather indirectly, the name we use for a certain Indian tribe even today.
That's right. There are earlier accounts of fire, but this one is particularly interesting because it does lead to the adoption of the name of the Brule Sioux. And the story is... The dates differ depending on which account you're reading, but supposedly I think it was probably about the winter of 1762-1763 when two young boys wandered away from their hunting camp to looking for prairie dogs or, you know, getting into trouble like young boys do, and a prairie fire came upon them and their village, and these boys should have been burned alive. I mean, it was, but miraculously they survived. They threw themselves on the ground, they covered themselves with their robes, and just waited for the fire to pass because that's all that they could do. The fire was just moving too quickly, and both of the boys escaped with only a burn on their right thigh, and so. Their people, and the fire went on to really hurt people, destroy a lot of the camp, and kill people in camp, kill animals in camp. So it was a major event for the people. And so after that, the people called themselves the people with the burnt thigh, and the French later came in and corrupted the name and began calling the people Brule or Burned Sioux. So that's kind of where those people get their name from a prairie fire.
In the Sioux tongue, transliterated by the French, it sounded like Sioux or something, in the word for people with a burnt thigh.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Right.
And that's the Brule Sioux. Julie Courtwright, this is fascinating, our conversation about prairie fire today. We're talking with Julie Courtwright, who joins us by phone from Ames, Iowa, about her book, Prairie Fire, A Great Plains History. After the break, you can call us by at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. And welcome back to the Walt Bodine Show. I'm here with Walt Monroe Dodd, his co-host, and today we're talking with Julie Courtwright about her new book, Prairie Fire, A Great Plains History. It's the little told story of the fires that have ranged across our part of the world for thousands of years, fires that affect us even today, even here in Kansas City. Julie is an assistant professor of history at Iowa State University, and she joins us by phone. Her concentration is on environmental history and the history of the American West. And you can join our conversation by calling 816 215-235-2888 or by emailing us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. And we have Don from Kansas City on the phone. Don, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Julie. Fascinating show today. I can't wait to get the book and read the book. I grew up in on the plains of Kansas myself. And my question is, if you could, would you like to experience firsthand a prairie fire in the Flint Hills today?
Absolutely. I hesitate because I all these things go through my mind of the horrible stories that I've read of people getting caught in prairie fires. But I think my curiosity and my fascination would outweigh my fear. Maybe that's naive of me. But I think it would be amazing. Now, and as the people of eastern Kansas are pretty aware, you can experience them at least marginally. All you have to do is drive along the turnpike in early April, especially at night, and you see the magnificent fires. But as far as experiencing a wild prairie fire, I would like to do that. But I read too many stories of people getting caught in them and how dangerous they can be. So I would like to experience them, but I would enter into it quite a bit of caution.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you. I have driven by 70 through the smoke clouds, and always thought it would be fun to just stop and kind of hang around, but can't really do that on the interstate. So
true. But you know, I encourage people when it's appropriate, you know, when it's safe, pull over and take a look. And you know, I hope that people can become more aware of why the ranchers are burning, and just, you know, how important the burning is to maintaining the tallgrass prairie. And too much of the tallgrass prairie is gone. The Flint Hills is the largest piece of tallgrass prairie left in the world. And
yes,
in order to maintain that, we need to burn it. And the ranchers do a great job of taking care of the land. And so I hope people can watch the fires, appreciate their beauty, but also, you know, understand why it's happening.
Yeah, I think a prairie fire also contains a personal metaphor in that if you live your life with some roots, you can survive the fire that comes and then come out stronger.
Very true. It's an excellent metaphor.
Don,
thanks for the book.
And Don, thank you for your call.
You're very welcome.
Julie, you write in your book on more than one occasion that prairie fires can actually, and you referred to it this morning, can have a certain hypnotic beauty. And you're not the only person to say this. Artists and others and travelers for more than a century have seen this. Can you describe the beauty they're talking about?
Oh, people talk about the color, and you know, having seen the controlled burns, there's especially at night, you have this. A lot of times, people call it a red serpent, because you have this line of red and orange fire, you know, snaking across the hillside, and when you contrast that with the blackness of night, it's just quite amazing. And the fires, particularly, you know, the descriptions of the wild prairie fires from the 19th century, the really big fires. You know, people just talk about how they stretch for miles and miles. And sometimes it's not just one line of fire, but it can break off into several different lines. One description I'm remembering talks about three parallel lines of fire stretching across just miles and miles of horizon. And so it creates this amazing red and orange glow and it's just quite striking, and a unique sight for this region. People, even though they were afraid of the fires, even though they wanted to stop the fires because they were a threat to property and a threat to life, even though all that was true, people still longed to see these fires because they were so beautiful and they were something so unique. This didn't happen in the East. And so people became very proud of the fires and how beautiful they were. And they, when their relatives came and visited in Kansas, for example, they'd take their relatives out to see a prairie fire if one was burning nearby, because like a tourist attraction, because it was so unique and identifying to the region.
So simultaneously fascinating and frightening to the people of the plains. You write that wind plays a huge role in whether a prairie fire is destructive or not.
True. If there's no wind, a prairie fire is not nearly as threatening. If there's no wind, especially on the short grass prairie, you know, further west where the grass is shorter, people could literally, a horse or even a person could literally step over a fire that is not driven by a wind. But if you put a strong wind behind it, it's a whole different ballgame, because the wind, you know, pushes the fire across the grass. And, you know, modern fires have been clocked at 30 miles per hour. So these things could really move, and that's what made them very dangerous. And so, you know, you had fires that certainly a person could not outrun, and a lot of fires even a horse could not outrun. And so you had to find another way to keep yourself safe and keep your children and your animals safe, because you couldn't run away.
Let's go now to Buzz in Tonganoxie. Good morning, Buzz.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question relates to does the book contain any reference to a prairie fire which extended, I believe, from the Platte River in Nebraska to the Republican in Kansas back in the 1880s? And I think it was a deliberately set prairie fire.
I do not remember that particular fire, but there was one in 1865 set by the military, actually, as part of during the Indian Wars, and it started at Fort Kearney in Nebraska all the way to Denver, and they lit the fire simultaneously, and that fire reportedly burned all the way south through Kansas to the Arkansas River. And some reports even have it jumping the Arkansas and heading down into all the way to the Texas Panhandle. So that's kind of the largest fire as far as geography is concerned that I'm aware of.
That's probably the one I'm thinking of. Of course, Kearney is the Platte River.
Oh, yeah, yes.
So, you know, and clearly if it extended beyond the Republican to the Arkansas. Well, thank you for your response. I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
Thank you, Buzz. GP in Prairie Village has written in by email to say, I grew up in the Hutchinson area and worked for the Hutchinson News for many years. We dealt with a lot of grass fires in the Sand Hills. The gusty, switching winds made fighting the fires extremely dangerous. I remember there being a lot more fires associated with wheat stubble catching on fire from the hot equipment used for the harvest rather than true prairie fires. Most of the fires in the tall grass prairie in the Flint Hills tend to be controlled burns. So here, Julie, I don't know if you'd call it carelessness, but it's not meant to be a prairie fire, and yet it became one even in our modern era.
Absolutely, and that's it's actually pretty common for farm vehicles and trucks and things to get hot enough underneath to set the grass on fire. And certainly as more and more of the prairie has been put into agriculture, you do get more wheat stubble burns than prairie, just simply because there's more of that around. But very, very true.
Let's go now to Ken in Greenwood. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. How are you all doing today?
Just fine, thanks.
Okay. I was right in the middle of a prairie fire once. This was in North Dakota in 1977. I worked in Minot, North Dakota as a mechanic, and then I lived out of town on a kind of a half farm, half estate thing. And it was towards late fall, and we got a call that there was a fire on top of the hill out of the valley. So they called us all together. We jumped on our trucks, and these are trucks built in the 50s and 60s with big water tanks on the back. And we had these welded platforms on the front bumper you stood on with the hose. And then they'd take you out in the field, and a couple guys would be on the bumper spraying down the fire. Well, there was four trucks out there, two from Burlington and two from Boxholm further up the road. And we got to the top of the hill, and we found where the fire was, right at the fence line. And there was four trucks now, and that fire jumped that fence line. The wind started picking up, and it started going around us, so we figured we'd head for the road, which is a little bit further down the hill. Well, there's a couple hills we had to go over first to get there, because it was about a mile and a half on top of the hill where the fire was. And anyway, we got just about to the top of the valley there, and the fire passed us, and we were surrounded by it. So this looked like Custer's last stand. I'm not kidding you. We were just about totally surrounded. So what we did is one of the trucks backed up and shot a stream down the hill, and we all went down the hill, single file, down to the gravel road, and got on the gravel road and sprayed the ditches, and then waited out the fire till it was passed. But we couldn't stop her. That's for sure, and that taught me a big lesson that sometimes Mother Nature's got more than you can pack, you know. But I just thought I'd throw that in.
Of course, modern technology, the spray trucks and things like that are a tremendous advantage. But what you described is very typical, and you know, just fires burn today like they did in the 19th century. They're maybe not quite so big and not quite so common as they used to be, but they burn the same way. They're very volatile, very dangerous, and very, very hard to stop when they're pushed by wind, and that's a great example of that. Of course, in the 19th century, they would have lit a backfire to stop the fire or plowed a fire guard or something like that, so we do have the advantage of some modern technology nowadays.
You're listening to The Walt Bodine Show on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, here with Julie Courtwright, talking about her new book, Prairie Fire, A Great Plains History. Have you experienced a prairie fire the way Ken did, or did your ancestors? Join us with your questions or your stories at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. Ken was telling us about an incident in South Dakota, Julie, and you in the book tell about a horrific story about a school near Belfield, South Dakota, back in 1914. Can you tell us that story, please, about prairie fire?
Sure. That was actually North Dakota, though.
North Dakota,
Belfield,
I'm sorry.
North Dakota, yeah. It was a relatively late fire, 1914, but this is the story that really got to me in the archives. I sat in countless archives on countless days reading story after story of people's experiences, and there were terrible, terrible stories that I read and heartbreaking stories, but this is the one that actually made me cry reading it, because it was around noon or 1 o'clock on a Friday. And it was a school, a rural school in Belfield, North Dakota. And the teacher, who was actually an Iowa native, 21-year-old woman from Iowa, she called her students in about 1 o'clock that afternoon, called them in from the lunch break, from the lunch recess. And at that time, she saw a prairie fire approaching the school. Now, immediately, she has to make a decision. Will she keep the children in the schoolhouse, or will she try to get them to a piece of plowed ground nearby? Because if they're on plowed ground, of course, then that deprives the fire from fuel, and they'll be safe on plowed ground. and she has seconds to make this decision. And she's 21 years old. You know, she's probably inexperienced with fire, and she decides to have the students run for the plowed ground. Now, keeping them in the schoolhouse might sound like a strange idea, but actually that would have been the better choice, because a lot of times schoolhouses were safe during fires, and that's because the land around the school was often worn away. The grass was worn off the land from years and years of children playing at recess. As they play, they wear the grass away. And so oftentimes around the schoolhouse, there's a fire block because there's no grass. And so that's why she thought about keeping them in the schoolhouse. But in this case, she decides to have the children run for plowed ground. They run. Five of the boys got confused by the smoke, and they were probably very frightened, and they went in the wrong direction. So the teacher and another older girl, who was the sister of one of the boys, ran after the boys, and all seven of them were trapped and caught by the fire. The fire ran over them. And so reports of this incident, two men were the first people to arrive on the scene after the fire had passed, and they found seven people burned, lying on the ground. Only a couple of them were dead. The others were still alive, but in very, very bad shape. There were quite a number of children that did make it to the plowed ground and were safe. But six of them children, died that day. And the teacher, they carried the teacher's body into the schoolhouse, and she lived for several hours just in agony. And she blamed herself for making the wrong decision. And just the fact of thinking of what that teacher went through and the fact that she was so young and probably so inexperienced, and that she, you know, made the wrong choice and that led to the death of these children, is just a heartbreaking story. Now, that one's probably the worst that I came across. But there are other, you know, other stories that just tell just how dangerous these fires can be.
And so the schoolhouse survived after all.
Schoolhouse survived, yes. If she would have kept them inside the school, no one would have been hurt. So that was what she was, even in her agony, she was blaming herself for that decision.
Now, you're right that there's been a certain diminishment of these massive prairie fires in the 20th century, but there still are range fires. Some people call it burning pasture. And they're supposedly controlled and planned by ranchers and perhaps even farmers, but some have untoward effects. And you write about one where the smoke blew across the Kansas Turnpike and caused quite a bit of difficulty.
Back in the mid-90s, that happened, where smoke went across the highway and caused an accident, and that led to Kansas placing signs along the turnpike. Warning drivers not to drive into dense smoke. If there's dense smoke that's crossing the road, then you need to pull over and wait for it to pass. It was because of that accident that those signs were posted. But that's, you know, that incident, it was tragic, but it was unusual. The vast majority of the time, the burns in the Flint Hills go on without incident and without causing problems like that.
And if those of us listening in the Kansas City area think that we are immune to the results of prairie fires, it wasn't that long ago that prairie fires on the plains caused a change in our ozone count right here in Kansas City.
True. There's been some controversy in recent years about the burning that happens in April because it does cause air quality issues in both Wichita and Kansas City. And so the EPA has kind of stepped in and questioned about the timing of the burns and whether they can be timed differently. The answer is they really can't. The ranchers need to burn at a particular time. They need to burn that last week of March, those first couple weeks of April. The timing is important because if you don't burn at the right time, then the grass doesn't come in the way it should. If you don't burn at the right time, then you're not killing off the woody intruders, the trees and brush that are starting to creep in during that early spring. And so for generations now, both the American Indians and the ranchers in the Flint Hills have been burning at this time of year, and they really need to burn at that time of year. And so it does cause, you know, some air quality concerns for a few days in the spring. But the result is, you know, that the tall grass prairie is maintained and you know, continues to thrive in Kansas.
You quote one rancher from the area as saying, well, if Kansas City is worried about its ozone count, maybe it should have fewer cars.
yeah, well, the argument there is that air quality in the cities are affected by a lot more things than just burning in the Flint Hills for a few days every spring. And so, in my mind anyway, a few air quality concerns for a couple days in April, it's worth it in order to maintain this ecosystem.
Let's go now to Gloria in Gladstone. Good morning, Gloria.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
And go ahead.
Yes. When I was a young teenager living on a farm, a fire was coming over the hill. I don't know whether it was set by a farmer, you know, way over or what. But we were home by ourselves. My father and mother had left. And so the four of us older ones went out with, you know, like gunny sacks and tried to fight this fire because it was way out with no water source. And thought we were doing pretty good, but then, you know, there was smoke and coughing some. But then all of a sudden, I don't know whether the wind picked up, but I was completely surrounded by thick white smoke. Everywhere I turned, you had no idea which way to go to get out of it. And that panic sets in and that fear, that's pretty strong because I was coughing so bad that I knew I was going to probably die of the smoke inhalation way before any fire. But since I do have an internal compass built in, well, I know some people that when I say north, south, they have no idea what I'm saying. But I did turn the correct way and got out of it. But I just wanted to say there's such a panic sets in when wherever you turn, you cannot see anything. And we had to get out, my three brothers and sisters. We just had to leave. The smoke was so horrific. And, of course, we didn't have cell phones back then to call our parents. But I think what happened was eventually people from another farm showed up, and then they took care of it, thank goodness. So I just wanted to relay that experience of what it feels like to be surrounded and you cannot see where you're at or which way to go. That's all.
Thank you, Gloria, for your call. Julie, your book is actually replete with examples of people inside these fires and the disorientation of the stuff that can take place.
Yes, and what she described, you know, sounded it could have been a story from back from, you know, 74 or something. Very, very typical, even using the gunny sacks. That was a very common way to fight fire, perhaps the most common way to fight fire was just to beat it with gunny sacks. And then the danger of being surrounded, the disorientation of the smoke. It was a very, very, very hard work to fight fire and frightening. And things could turn on a dime. You could think that you're in control of the situation, and then all of a sudden the wind shifts and you're not in control all of a sudden. One thing that people did, children traveling across the prairie that had to walk to school across the prairie, and other travelers as well, they would take matches with them, a whole pocket full of matches, so that if they got caught, as Gloria described, then they could start a backfire and try to protect themselves.
Wow. That's all the time we have for today's show. Our guest has been Julie Courtwright, talking about her new book, Prairie Fire, A Great Plains History. Julie grew up in Kansas in Prairie Fire country and now teaches history at Iowa State University. She's joined us today by phone from her office in Ames. Julie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You'll find our show's archives on our website. Visit kcur.org and click on the Walt Bodine Show. Our show was produced today by Andrea Salenzi. Our announcer is Kim Noble. I'm Monroe Dodd. I'll be back in 3 weeks for another history show. And Walt, enjoy your day.